are listening to the Geocaching Podcast, a podcast about everything geocaching, where you'll hear tips and tricks, interviews with cachers, and lots more. Welcome to episode 85 of the Geocaching Podcast. I'm your host, XPlex, with
Daryl W4 and
Montu Ryder.
If you want to participate in our show tonight, please call 724-444-7444, and our TalkCast ID is 7525. And just press the star 8 on your keypad or the next in queue on our press the request to talk at the top of the chat room live. We're talking with a pretty important geocacher tonight. And so if you want to ask any questions, give us a call, 724-444-7444. Our podcast ID is 7525. You can also join in live on our chat room to participate with our listeners, and that can be found at www.geocachingpodcast.info. Just click the Join Now to Participate button on the right. And during the week, if you've got any questions, comments, or anything, 206-350-3GPS is our voicemail line, and on Twitter, we can be found at twitter.com/GCPodcast. Welcome back, Montu and Daryl. Montu, how has your week been?
Well, this time pretty much uneventful. Spent the entire weekend on yard work. Had to get some brush cleaned up and lawn mowed, and thankfully the grass has about stopped on growing, so that's about the last time I'm going to have to do that. Other than that, just usual grind of work. How about you, Daryl?
Well, Geek Boy actually came in from Illinois, and we did some caching in the snow with Bill of TL4, and that was an interesting time, mostly getting out to the Howell area, which is where he was staying. We had, I'd say, somewhere in the range of like 6 to maybe even a dozen accidents, you know, not any fatal from what we could tell, but just nasty accidents, and that was before we even left Metro Detroit. So it was a fun time caching in the snow, and it was driving for a while there. But north of Ann Arbor, we had about 18 caches for the day. Only, I think, one of them was really a park and grab, but just always fun and always a blast, despite the cold and driving snow. And I did have a chance to play with a new app for the iPhone and the iPod Touch called Geocaching Buddy. Pretty cool, because it lets you drop in information about multi-caches and puzzle series. It's a $10 app, a little bit pricey if you're not going to do a whole lot of the multis or the series of caches, but if you are, it looks like it's going to be a great app, well worth the money, because you can keep your notes in there. It has options for variables. You can enter in some nice little formulas and stuff with the coordinates, so that as you go along, it's building the coordinates. You don't have to really worry about it. When you're done, you just hit the map or the navigate button, and it will take you there. So very nice little app so far. Look forward to playing with it a little bit more in the near future, and hopefully share a little bit more. Now, Andy, I think you had something a little bit pricier to play with.
Yeah, mine's a little bit more than $10, but I have a demo unit for the PN40, the DeLorme new GPS unit, and the first look at that can be found in our show notes, the unboxing of it. Hopefully soon here, in a couple weeks, we'll be getting a thorough, detailed review of it, but it's a lot of fun. I have to admit, it does take some getting used to, especially since I'm a Garmin user by heart, and so the PN40 is taking a little bit to get used to, but I do like it, and overall, I would definitely have to recommend it, but you'll get more on that later and soon. So let's get on with our topic tonight. We've got Mountain Bike on the interview with us. Welcome to our show, Mountain Bike.
Hey there, guys.
Well, I first contacted you to be on our show because I'm interested in a few things, but your Northwest Trails. Can you tell us a little bit about that? It's from what I understand, a Garmin map set that you created. What made you want to create that?
Well, I've been collecting tracks for a long time. I was doing that, I was the first thing that got me into GPS was collecting tracks to map for mountain biking. And so I started in 1995 and would just record things as I rode different trails and visited different trails. And, of course, over time, I collected a huge number of those. And I always wanted to have everything in my GPS. But, of course, tracks loaded into a GPS only allow you usually around 20 tracks and usually of a lower fidelity than originally recorded. You know, you can only have, for example, in most Garmin GPSs, 20 tracks with a maximum of 500 points. Well, over time, it became, almost immediately, you exceed the capabilities of your GPS to hold tracks. And so I just had a bunch of tracks on my computer, and as I would go to areas, I would load up the tracks of interest. Of course, it was such a small amount that I looked for other options, and, it took me a long time, but just here in the past year, I finally decided to start making custom map set for uploading to Garmin units, and it acts like it's a transparent layer essentially. So if you have another map set, say Topo Maps, the trails will lay over that map set without hiding it. You'll be able to see all of your trails all at once on your GPS. You're not limited by the memory, the track memory. And they take up a very small amount of map space compared to the larger maps like City Navigator or Topo. And I started doing that for my own tracks, and then I thought, well, you know, it'd be nice to do places I haven't been yet. And so I started collecting data from various GIS sources, like the Forest Service. Websites would host data downloads of their trail systems and what have you. And it just expanded from there. And after about a month, I figured, you know, I bet there are other people who are in my boat as well, other people who would want to see all the trails available on their GPS at once. And so I decided to put together a quick web page and send out a notice to some friends who had Garmin GPSs that would allow them to kind of beta test it for me. And when I was sure that I wasn't messing up anyone's GPS unit, I just posted in forums on Groundspeak saying, hey, I've got this map set. Take a look if you're interested. And that was last March, and it's been going pretty well this year.
Now, I've noticed in Twitter that you've had quite a couple people who have requested that their trail's been taken off. What's happening there? What's the story there?
The trails that so far I've only had one outright request. One individual who works for the Forest Service said that his boss wanted to contact me to discuss removal of some trails. The Forest Service has some trails that they would rather not be publicized, I guess. That has not nothing's progressed from that initial contact. I've not been contacted at all saying, please remove X trail or whatever. So I'm kind of holding my breath, hoping that nothing comes of that. The other one was an issue of a guy I met through this mapping project who supplied quite a bit of data for me, all of which was originally from public sources. So it was all Forest Service data. He attributed it in some ways for his use, but those attributions were not anything I used in the project. But in any case, he delivered that data. When I started, you know, not everyone has a Garmin GPS, and some people have other uses they'd like to have that data for. I started releasing GPX and KML of the whole data set, and that's what upset him. He felt it was giving away data for free. My opinion had been that it was originally public anyway. I wasn't taking any information that he had added to the data. In fact, he had had some datum shifts or something on big chunks of the data. I had to do a lot of manual editing of the data to bring it back to the proper spatial location. So I really felt like it had been handed off to me at that point, and it was public data / my data, and that I could do what I wanted with it. But as a show of good faith, I pulled those mass data downloads just so as not to upset him. And you know, I didn't want to cause any friction with a guy who had, you know, helped me track down some data from various government agencies that didn't have websites with it posted.
Sure. And I mean, it's kind of interesting because, I mean, you are letting your data, your maps free to begin with, and he knew that when giving the information to you. So that's interesting that he would find problems with that.
Yeah, I guess he didn't mind, you know, giving data to me because the way I was redistributing it was in a form that wasn't easily, sucked down and used by others other than for that specific use of uploading it to a GPS. When I went to the GPX, it opened up the door to, you know, anyone could come to the site, of course, and grab the data. And he felt that was just, you know, giving away a lot of effort. It's true in that sense. You know, it takes work to put together a big data set like that from various sources, but
sure.
My opinion has always been that these are, you know, for the public to use. This is public data. You know, this is a community effort to try to get this information out there. So I've never thought of it as a money-making thing. I think it depends on the perspective at which you come at a project like this. For me, it was just a you know, following an interest and exploring a passion and trying to share that with others. Whereas I think he's thinking along the lines of, you know, we could probably market this.
Sure. Now, what kind of tool do you use to create this meta?
Well, it takes a few tools, actually. I wish there was one easy one. Probably the one I use the most is Global Mapper, which is a piece of GIS software. It's a little more limited than one of the big GIS application suites like ArcGIS, but it's so simple to use, and it converts a lot of different types of data. It allows you to easily overlay aerial imagery and topo imagery and edit tracks or points or what have you. So usually when data is sent to me, I first pull it into Global Mapper and make any edits that are necessary there and give it the attributes that I keep for my data. If I need to do a bulk selection or editing, then I go to one of the bigger GIS packages. I use ArcGIS. And in there, I can do all kinds of spatial analyses or do a mass selection and change of a data field or something. But that's more limited in what I do with that. Once I have all of the data in the form that I want, I export it as a shapefile from Global Mapper, and then I use a program called cGPS Mapper. That's available at cgpsmapper.com. With that, I can there's another application in there too, GPS Map Edit. It's in GPS Map Edit, I pull the data, those shape files in, and it gets them into the form that cGPS Mapper can work with, and then I export it as the image file that cGPS Mapper works with. That gives me the image files, which are the actual files that are uploaded to the GPS. And then finally, I package that all with a piece of open source installation software that's available out there.
sounds like a lot of work, but I mean, it definitely sounds like it's worth it. If anyone in our chat room has any questions, go ahead and type them in. We'll ask Mountain Bike, or if you want to call us, 724-444-7444, and our TalkCast ID is 7525. Press the *8 key on your keypad to request to talk, or the request to talk at the top of the chat room if you're in a chat room. I think it's an awesome project. I wish I lived in your area so I could use it. It wouldn't do me much good here in Indiana. But you do have a website, and that is northwesttrails.com, correct?
No, actually, it's switchbacks.com.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, that's correct. I knew that. I've been emailing you, and I just totally forgot about that. I'm sorry. So switchbacks.com is your website where all the information can be found, correct?
Correct.
All right. Any other questions from our chat room? If not, I think Daryl has a few questions. Daryl?
Yeah, I was going to move on to the early caching experiences. I know you were one of the early adopters of geocaching. Could you tell us a little about those early days, and what was it that motivated you to sign up for geocaching?
Well, as I mentioned while talking about maps, I had been into GPS since the mid-90s and was just passionate about the technology. I was an avid reader of the news groups, and there, as selective availability, the shutoff was looming. There was a lot of buzz, and you know, GPS users were excited because all of a sudden our receivers were going to be so much more powerful. And I saw Dave Ulmer's initial post saying he planned to hide something in the woods and people would be able to find it now if he just posted coordinates. I thought that sounded like a fun idea and a great way, a entertaining way to use these receivers. May 3rd, 2000 came and went. The shutoff of selective availability was on the first or the second our time zone, I think it was. And anyway, the next day he had posted that he had hidden that bucket. And if only I had known how big the game would have become, I would have probably raced down to Portland to try to find it. But it was a 3-hour drive, and it just, you know, it seemed like just a novelty, of course. And I didn't think too much about it other than the fact that I would like to do the same thing, you know, hide one in my area. I waited for the snow to melt because May is pretty snowy in where we have our cabin. I wanted to pick a special place, and I wanted it to be up in the mountains near our cabin in North Idaho. So I waited until the snow receded enough that I could make my way up to the top of this one mountain that's near us and planted my 5-gallon bucket and posted the coordinates, and that ended up being the first cache in Idaho, and it was, I think, the 40th cache overall placed in the world, and that was June 17th or something like that, and I kind of watched all summer waiting for someone to visit, and no one ever did, and actually very few caches were placed that first summer, and I thought, well, it really was a novelty. It's dead, you know, right out of the barrel. I actually didn't even find a cache until September because none popped up in my area. And by my area, I mean within a mile or within an hour's drive. And then finally, at the end of September, we had been working pretty hard on a project here at work, and we shipped. And that afternoon, after shipping, I jumped in the car and drove out to this cache site that was about an hour away and found my first cache. It happened to be a cache hidden by Jeremy, the founder of Groundspeak. But then it was several months before I found my second cache because there just weren't that many around. And I figured, okay, here comes the winter. There'll be no activity. And there wasn't. But that next February, as we were coming out of winter, I don't know if it was because of sale of GPSs after, you know, now that they were so much more accurate or what, but there was this big uptick in activity and caches started getting placed left and right. Granted, not at the rates that we see today, but still quite a bit compared to what had happened that first year. And the game was off, and I was into it fully.
Now, that's definitely a lot different than what we're kind of used to today with the urban caches and micros. So you've seen that whole evolution. Could you kind of talk a little bit about your views on what's happened to geocaching and what you like and maybe even what you don't like?
Well, I like the variety. When I started, it was, I was so naive. It's just, I laugh. I put in what I think, I don't know of a traveler older than it. I think it was the very first traveler. Travel bugs weren't around at the time. But I put this frog in, and on the bottom it said, "I am the stash hopper." It was a plastic frog, a lawn ornament type. I put, "I am the stash hopper. Please move me from stash to stash." We didn't even call them caches back then. They were stashes. And I was so naive. I thought, here's this giant thing that fits well in a 5-gallon bucket. But that's about it. Even a 50-gallon or a 50-caliber ammo can these days would not fit it very well. But I thought, that's what these caches are. You know, they're these big 5-gallon buckets. And when the smaller caches started coming out, it was like, oh, yeah, you know, you can use a lot. There are actually things that work much better than 5-gallon buckets. As I learned early on with mine, that the 5-gallon buckets, although they feel really sturdy and strong, really deteriorate when out in the woods. And, you know, ammo cans are far and away better than they are. But not, you know, it was one thing to realize you could use different containers. It was a whole other thing to realize that you could use these tiny bison tubes or now nanos. And it was, I hadn't even thought of the idea of putting one in the middle of a downtown area. You know, it was just not in the cards. It just didn't strike me as a possibility. But that is when you look at the variety of containers that are available now. So I think, I've really enjoyed seeing that explode and see all the variety. On the other hand, the thing I don't like is I think that over time, people have lost sight of the importance of location in hiding something. It's now, it doesn't matter where it is. It's just as long as they can, they will. And I think you see that loss of the importance of location in a lot of the aspects of the game, the things that are called micro spew or power trails or whatever. You know, I think a power trail is fine if you're looking at interesting spots at each location. If you're just putting out a bunch of caches just because you can, I think that loses some of the sight of some of the things, at least that led to the creation of the game. It's not the location is secondary to the cache at that point. Not, I still like to put the location ahead of the cache.
We have a number of people in the chat room seconding your thoughts on the location.
Even Groundspeak, their initial motto or company tagline was the language of location. I think they still use that, but I think that has been lost a bit on some aspects of the game. Not their fault, certainly. It's just the game has it has grown so much that, you know, things like that are bound to happen. I just hope that growth patterns don't swamp out some of the things that lead the game to be interesting to a variety of people. And not just those addicted to numbers.
Now, we have a couple of questions from the chat room, actually. One comes from, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the name right, Herkenham, and they want to know if the early caches commonly involved trades of items more valuable than swag for kids.
I always joke to myself that I do not remember at all what I picked up out of the first cache I did. So what I would say is that the contents were never a factor. I know that what Jeremy put in that first cache of his, and that was the first cache I found, were various marketing items from the company he was with that was going out of business. But I'll be darned if I can remember. I think one was a yo-yo, but I didn't take a yo-yo. So I would say that for me, I never really saw a change in the quality of the stuff in the cache. And I may not have even taken anything out of that first cache. It was still, for me, all about the location and getting to the location.
And then someone else wanted to know if that first Idaho cache that you placed was still active.
Oh, yes, it still is. I'm doing my best to make sure it stays. When, like I mentioned, that my 50-gallon, or 50-gallon, boy, that would be a big one, my 5-gallon bucket deteriorated. The lid actually, it gets hit very rarely. In fact, it took almost a year for it to get its first visit. The lid, just from the few times it's popped off and put back on during a year, it caused it to just break apart. So I actually went back and modified it so that it is now an easy-to-open 5-gallon bucket with drainage at the bottom and an ammo can inside of that. The 5-gallon bucket just it collected water. The lid would crack and the sides would crack as well. I finally just kept kind of an outer casing of a 5-gallon bucket just to preserve the original form, but for safety, or you know, for to keep it drier and safer, I put an ammo can inside of that. So I've had to make changes along the way from its initial form, but have tried to keep it as true to the original as before. Of course, I broke one of the tenets of caching with my first hide, and that was I buried the cache. I filled it, or I sank it down into the ground with just part of the rim showing. Of course, there were no guidelines back then, and it struck me as just the woods. I would not do that again now, but I've not changed that until land managers ask me to. I've not changed that just so I can keep it as it was originally.
Sure. Now, you've been credited as one of the people who start trackables through your first coin. Could you share about that story?
Yeah, that was actually just the luck of timing. I had been into Travelers. I had started what I think is the first Traveler. At least it's the first one that I've found documented anywhere, and that was that Stash Hopper I was talking about. So I'd always been interested in the moving of items. And then fast forward to September of 2001, I was nearing my 100th cache find, and I wanted to place something special to commemorate 100, which at that time was an important milestone for me. And so I came up with this idea of coins, thanks to a friend of mine who had been in the military, and when we were talking about signature items, he mentioned that you could have custom coins made. And, you know, when I looked into that, I thought, wow, that's a perfect geocaching item because they're small, easy to carry. You can design whatever you want on them, and they're durable. So even in a cache that leaks, you know, they're going to survive. So I had some minted up, and I was asking about places, you know, that would make a good milestone cache, and I got a recommendation from a good caching friend who's still a good caching friend today. And during the conversation, Jeremy indicated he'd be interested in joining me. So we went up to the spot, which was just off of Whidbey Island here in western Washington, and he was at that time just releasing travel bugs. He had placed the first one or two already on a trip down to, I think it was Arizona. And as we were driving, he was telling me about it. And I mentioned my coins, and well, he knew about the coins. He said, well, would you like to track those? I said, well, that'd be great, but, you know, they're just numbers. All I have is, you know, they're numbered sequentially. He said, oh, that's okay. We can just make those numbers trackable. That turned out to be a little bit of a problem later on, like today.
Yeah.
But I thought that was so cool. And so he made them trackable. And I put the first one, actually, I kept the first one for me, but I put the second one into that cache that was my 100th. And it started from there. Of course, now I do, as I mentioned, I do wish that I had had some code or you know, that semi-random alphanumeric code, because pretty much anything that has a number on it these days gets logged accidentally as one of my coins, which causes
True.
A lot of log maintenance for me.
I bet. Now, Mantu, you had a couple questions about coins.
Yes, I did. Now, which coin out of the ones that you've made would you say is your favorite? And is there an overall favorite out of all the many coins that you have seen in your travels, either made by you or by someone else?
Boy, that's a good question, and that's a really hard one to answer. And it seems like most people have liked my version 3 coin the most. But I've always felt like it came out just a little too gaudy. I like it, it looks more like a medallion and not a coin. So I think my sentimental favorite, well, obviously I like the version 1 just because it was the first one that I had made, and so it has a special place. But for design, I've always liked the version 2 the best. There were no gimmicks on it, well, unless you count the hidden code that could be used to find a cache. But it was a coin. It was, it did have color, so it had a little bit more brightness than the first one was very plain. But it was round, it was flat, it didn't have any moving parts. It was a coin. And, I thought it was the right size as well. It was 1 5/8, same as the first one. The version 3 ballooned to 3 inches, and that I felt was just too big. For my version 4, I went back to a simpler design, although, excuse me, it does have a spinning wheel. I wanted to try to incorporate a biking element, so it spins like a wheel, a bike wheel. I still look back on that second one as kind of my favorite. You know, it was the first one that I had made up that incorporated the area where we have our cabin in North Idaho. So it was important to me for that purpose too.
Now, is there? This was actually a question from our forum. Is there going to be a mountain Christmas coin this year?
No, I have. My wife would not give it the okay this year. She's still the boss.
Got to keep those wives happy.
Yeah. I spent too much on GPSs this year, and she said, nope, that's enough for that hobby.
Now,
I looked at your map earlier, and I see you've been caching pretty much across a good portion of the U.S. With some areas where you haven't gotten to yet. Where's your next goal to go caching at?
Well, I have plans in May to some friends and I started an extended weekend annual trip, meaning we started a trip and said, hey, let's do this every year, but not make it too long, you know, so that it's not too hard to schedule. So we take like 4, maybe 5 days and hit a spot of the country we haven't been to before. The first year we went to Colorado, Kansas, Nebraska, and Wyoming. In fact, if you look on my map of finds, you could probably see the circle we did. The primary goal on that was to hit Mingo, which is the oldest active cache in the world right now. And then this year we went to the East Coast and hit Massachusetts and New England and a little bit of New York. Next year, so this coming May, we're planning to make a trip to Maryland, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., Virginia, kind of that mid-Atlantic seaboard area. So that's next on the list.
Well, if you ever decide to head into the Tampa Bay area, keep look me up.
Yeah, I've only caught just a corner of Florida, and that was on a trip with my wife, actually.
And we actually have there's a 50-gallon cache down here. And that's no slip.
Yeah. See, I wasn't making a mistake. That's really, yeah, that would be pretty nice. I imagine it's not hard to find.
It's somewhat difficult considering where it's at. It's a nice wilderness preserve.
Oh, that's good.
I just have a question here. I mean, you said you buy a lot of GPSs. What's your favorite line of GPSs?
Overall, Garmin, hands down. But I say that as being a very biased. I've never owned Magellan, for example. But for Northwest Trails, I have been struggling for months trying to get a Magellan version of my maps out. There have been some requests for that, but it is so complicated. The tools that are there are not widely used. They are very old. In fact, I had some problems with them running on Windows Vista initially. And there are so many little quirks of getting Magellan maps working that I think three times I started trying to get them to go and just drop the project because of the time it was taking. And finally, this last time, just actually last week, I finally discovered the error I was making, probably would continue to make if not for the fact that someone told me, you have to do this despite what the instructions say, and got them working. Just the fact that it is so much easier to customize my Garmin than anything I can see for Magellan has really made me a Garmin fan. It's some of that customizability, I guess, that has really got me interested in the DeLorme. I just picked up a PN40 this past week, right before I went on a trip up to Alaska. Didn't have time to sit down with it and get it ready, so I haven't had a chance to play with it yet. Already I'm seeing that it's a learning curve compared to the Garmin. As someone who's used to the way Garmin does things, I'm having to relearn a lot of things to get them to work on the DeLorme. And I'm not ready yet to say if it's just harder to use it as I want to or if I'm just not familiar with it yet. But
yeah,
I'm working on that.
Same thing for me. I've got that demo unit of the PN40 that I'm going to be reviewing for the podcast. And same thing. I'm a Garmin guy, and it's taking a little bit to get used to.
I'm waiting to post any review of my own until I've had some time. I don't want to go off, you know, without all the information. So I'm still playing with it, and the things I like about it, I really like about it, though. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'll see.
Now, another question in our chat room was, do you use PC or Mac software?
I use, I'm a PC guy. I happen to work for a company that's kind of, I guess, favorably inclined to go towards Windows, you might say. And so I was originally a Mac person, though, because I started out in science. In school, everything was Mac. So I was a Mac user for a long time until I started working for this company. And it's only then that I've become a PC guy. So I still very much enjoy the Mac, and I'm working on making my maps as easy to use for Mac users as possible. One of the users of Northwest Trails has actually put together an installer for for Northwest Trails to help those who are on the Mac get it installed more easily than what I have out there right now. So I'm working on getting that polished and what have you. And so, yes, I'm a PC guy, but I definitely respect the Mac side.
Someone again wants to know, do you speak at events?
Do I? I'm sorry?
Someone wants to know if you speak at events.
As you've probably been able to tell from this interview, I'm not much of a speaker. So, no, I usually defer to someone who's a little more gifted in that area.
Yeah, and we had someone else in our thing say, a Windows PC company in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as I've seen from Twitter, I know where you work.
Yeah.
So. Is there any other questions here tonight that we have in the chat room? Go ahead and type them in. Otherwise, we'll be winding this down. Anyone else have any other questions? All right. I want to thank you for being on the show tonight. It's great to be able to talk to someone who's seen geocaching from before it was the beginning. Thanks again for being on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we enjoyed talking with you. So. With that, we do this every week, Tuesday at 9:30 p.m., guys. Join us on the TalkShoe service. You can call us 574-444-7444. And our talk, Cassidy, is 7525. All of our show notes and links to all the past podcasts can be found at geocachingpodcast.info. And we have a voicemail line, 206-350-3GPS. And leave us a voicemail anytime. And again, we wish everybody a warm and happy Christmas time. And thanks for joining us tonight, everybody.